The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Gia Kokotakis, intern at Lawfare, with an episode of Rational Security for July 16th, 2023. For today's episode, the team at Lawfare decided to cross-post this week's episode of Rational Security, a podcast hosted by Scott R. Anderson, Quinta Jurassic, and Alan Rosenstein, in which they cover the week's big national security news stories. Today's episode is entitled The Long Middle Finger of Europe Edition. This week, Anderson, Jurassic, and Rosenstein sat down with Ravi Agrawal to discuss NATO's annual summit in Vilnius, the Biden administration's controversial decision to send U.S. cluster munitions to Ukraine, Mark Zuckerberg's launch of Threads, and more. This is Rational Security.
So every time I think about Vilnius, which, to be honest, I don't think about very often, I just think of the Hunt for Red October. And I'm just wondering if I'm the only person that is treating this as the Hunt for Red October themed NATO summit.
Probably yes, but I do get the reference.
I shouldn't be the only person. That's sad.
I can only think of Russian being spoken with a Scottish accent thanks to that movie. It's like the first 3 minutes where they actually have Sean Connery speaking Russian before they zoom in on his mouth and then they all switch to English is like the most distinctly Scottish accented Russian you can ever hear, and it's amazing. It's a great movie. I love that movie, but that part of it is like hard to get out of your head.
It's an amazing movie, and so my I think I mentioned this a few times. My parents were born in the Soviet Union, and I grew up speaking Russian. And this is also one of my parents' favorite movies because it's an amazing movie, and I saw it 17 times when I was a kid. And we all love everything about it, but I do recall every time the first few scenes of Sean Connery going Haladriga, which is him saying it's very cold in Russian with a Scottish accent. You could see my father kind of twitch a little bit. It's so painful to listen to if you speak Russian. It's amazing though.
So this is probably a bad time for me to admit that I've never actually seen The Hunt for Red October.
Oh, that's not acceptable.
My gosh.
You need to fix that immediately. I'll watch Chinatown if you watch Hunt for Red October.
I was trying to remember what movie you had seen.
Chinatown.
For a moment, I thought it was The Godfather, but it's Chinatown.
It had been The Godfather until a year ago.
God damn it, Alan.
I want to know, Ravi, when did you see The Hunt for Red October?
Well, I've just been sitting silently because I'm embarrassed. I haven't seen it. Oh, I have seen Chinatown and The Godfather. But, you know, on movies, there's a joke within our family that you never admit to what you haven't seen, because with my in-laws and my wife, the minute you say you haven't seen X in front of them, there's this collective chorus of like, oh my God, how could you have not seen it? We have to watch it now. Okay, we're going to drop everything and we're going to watch it now. And so I just sit silent.
But the Hunt for Red October is worth dropping everything to watch.
Okay, I will do it.
It is a great movie.
What this reminds me of, there's a scene in a David Lodge novel. He writes comic novels about campus life where there's a group of professors who are playing a game where you have to name the most embarrassing book that you haven't read. They're all in English literature. And so, you know, they're one-upping each other, right? They haven't read Joyce, etc. And one of them wins the game by saying he hasn't read Hamlet. But then he gets fired.
Let that be a cautionary tale to anyone who has not watched Land Before October and claims to be a foreign policy expert.
Exactly. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Rational Security. I am one of your co-hosts, Scott R. Anderson, thrilled to be here in the virtual studio this week with my two other co-hosts, Quinta Jurassic.
Hello.
And Alan Rosenstein.
Hello, hello.
And we are thrilled to be back for the second time with our esteemed guest, the editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy Magazine, Ravi Agrawal. Ravi, thank you much for joining us again today this week.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be on. Thanks for having me.
Well, we are excited to have you back on the podcast because we have had a very busy week in international affairs in the world, which I know you and your wonderful outlet have been watching very closely. We have seen some big meetings going down in Europe, a big show of strength by European and NATO allies to Russia. And in honor of that, we're calling this week's episode the Long Middle Finger of Europe edition, as the long shadow of the collective signal Europe is trying to send to Russia and its allies falls across the continent from Vilnius to Moscow.
As always on Rational Security.
Classy as always. Classy as always. For our first topic this week, Pledge Week. In a sign of strength, NATO held its annual summit in the capital city of Vilnius, Lithuania this week, just kilometers from the border with Belarus. But those hoping to join the club have gotten a bit of a mixed reception, with NATO members securing a clear path for Sweden to join the alliance at last, without presenting quite as clear a way forward for embattled Ukraine. What did we learn about the state of the alliance from this week's historic meeting? Topic two, cluster ruckus. Late last week, the Biden administration made the controversial decision to provide U.S. cluster munitions, a type of weapon that many U.S. allies have banned by treaty due to concerns about civilian casualties, to its ally Ukraine. Is it the right move, and what might it mean on the battlefield and after the war is over? Topic three, needling and threads. Mark Zuckerberg appears to have finally gotten under the skin of tech billionaire Elon Musk, as his recently launched competitor to Musk's beleaguered Twitter platform, Threads, launched last week and soon secured over 100 million users. Has Twitter finally met its match, and what will Threads and other competitors mean for the future of the information and disinformation economy? For our first topic, Alan, let me hand it over to you to get us started.
So the leaders of NATO are meeting this week, as they do once a year, this time in Vilnius in Lithuania. So usually these NATO summits are always interesting, but they're often devoted to sort of technical topics about cooperation and mostly cajoling from America to NATO member states to increase their defense spending. Obviously, this year it's quite a bit different with the Russia's invasion of Ukraine entering into its second year with no obvious end in sight. There are a lot of stories here. I think two have been the main ones. One, obviously, is the war in Russia and NATO support for Ukraine, Zelensky coming and trying at the very least to get assurances of continued support, which I think does appear to be the case, but also hitting some real roadblocks in what has been, quite aggressive campaign from him to try to get NATO membership. I don't think he thought or anyone thought that NATO was going to extend Ukraine membership while Ukraine was fighting a war with Russia, because of course then NATO would be fighting a war with Russia, which, as President Biden has pointed out, would be the definition of World War III. But Zelensky clearly wants a clear timeline after the war is over for Ukraine to join NATO. And there's been some pushback, and I think we should talk about why that is and whether, you know, what the merit or lack of merit is to that. So that's kind of the main story number one. And the main story number two is Turkey, and in particular Turkey's president Erdogan, finally stopping, at least for the moment, playing the role of spoiler in Sweden's ascension to NATO. Sweden and Finland, of course, decided to join NATO after Russia's invasion. Finland has since joined, and the main stumbling block for Sweden was Erdogan, because of some concerns about Sweden not doing enough to combat what Erdogan views as anti-Turkish Kurdish terrorists in Sweden. Erdogan seems to have decided to stop being annoying in this regard, and so it looks like Sweden will join NATO. So a lot to discuss there. But first, I just want to go to you, Ravi. I mean, a NATO conference is maybe the kind of platonic ideal of foreign policy issues. And so I'm sure you have just a lot of thoughts generally. What's your general takeaway from how this is going? And we should also note, you know, as usual, we're recording this on Wednesday morning. The NATO summit is very much ongoing. So by the time this podcast drops, which will be on Thursday, you know, some of the details may have changed.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the headline really is that much of the summit has proceeded as planned, other than the big flip-flop from Turkey's Erdogan, who, you know, for the longest time said that, you know, certain conditions needed to be met for Sweden to join NATO. The day before the summit, he dangled the idea that Sweden's entry into NATO was in some way sort of dependent on Turkey entering the EU, which was a whole separate set of discussions. Then suddenly sort of flip-flopped at the end when he announced that he would back Sweden's accession into NATO. That sort of surprised, I think, some observers, at least in terms of the way in which he did that. And again, I think much of that can be tied to the fact that the US is going to speed up some deliveries of F-16 fighters to Ankara. And also the fact that Turkey actually really needs the West much more than it did before, because its economy seems to be struggling in a variety of ways. So we might end up seeing a different Erdogan and a different Turkey in the next few years in this sort of latest iteration of Turkey under Erdogan after he won re-election recently. But more broadly, I think, you know, the bits that we were expecting were increased security guarantees to Ukraine. We already knew that the US would end up giving cluster munitions to Ukraine. And I think Zelensky seemingly upset at the fact that Ukraine not only can't join NATO, which no one expected was going to happen while Ukraine is at war, because that would mean all of NATO would have to join in the war as well in a formal way. But more than that, I think he seems to have been upset that there hasn't been much sort of a much description of a clear pathway for how Ukraine could join in the future. And the argument there really is that if there isn't a clear pathway, and that if you kick the can down the road, then that emboldens the likes of Putin to keep doing what he's doing. So my sense is that that's really a broad overview, but we mustn't forget that Sweden's joining is actually a big deal. I think it has tangible, real changes for the security alliance. It's also one more knock against Russia, because it sort of confirms that Russia's decision to invade Ukraine has kind of backfired. And then lastly, the whole thing, as many things are in diplomacy, is a show of force. And the fact that all of these member states, 31, soon to be 32, can get together in this way with all this attention from the world's media is another signal of the group's rejuvenation and strength. And Putin will be watching that very closely.
Yeah, I just wanted to pull out one point, which was about Sweden's joining. And you pointed out that if Sweden joins, there are some real strategic implications here. And I'd love for you to actually just draw that out a little bit. We hear a lot about how big of a deal it would be if the Baltic Sea becomes a NATO lake, I think is the term. But why exactly? I mean, you know, Russia still has Kaliningrad.
Yeah, there are quite a few reasons why Sweden's joining, I think, is being seen as an important addition. I mean, so Finland joined already. Finland, traditionally neutral, shares this long border with Russia. But Sweden has a very strong navy, which would end up strengthening NATO's defenses in the Baltic Sea. It also builds its own fighter jets, which sort of diversifies the types of fighter jets that the alliance as a whole uses. And if there is any sort of backlog or struggles to sort of resupply, then the fact that they do their own thing is also seen as very useful. But then, I mean, you know, the increased sort of presence in the Baltics also is very helpful. I mean, the Baltic Sea itself is a strategic waterway. It's bordered by St. Petersburg, as well as other sort of vulnerable NATO states. You've, of course, got Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania around all of that. So, you know, all of that makes Sweden's accession really important. And then lastly, it's a member of the Arctic Council, which in the end would allow NATO to sort of be more of a player and to sort of shift its kind of focus a little bit more northwards as well, further putting pressure on Russia. All of that, I'm sure, when Vladimir Putin looks at that as outcomes, very clear outcomes from Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Those are big setbacks for him.
I think that's a really astute observation about the big impact on Sweden. Although I also want to voice a little bit of a note of caution that the Sweden saga is categorically over, which seems to be what people are assuming here. The process of NATO expansion generally has certain procedural steps. They actually essentially adopt a corresponding international agreement to when they bring additional members into NATO. And that agreement has to be approved by the individual national governments once it's drafted and circulated. And that's a step, meaning that there's at least a couple more weeks or months in which you could see Erdogan shift his position, adjust his position, seek additional leverage. I mean, Erdogan is a guy who is kind of notoriously mercurial, as I think his recent performance underscores, and shameless about really pursuing even small marginal advantage and using every bit of leverage he has. So I wouldn't be surprised if we hear a little more chatter that throws a little dust in the way, although certainly making a public statement at such a large event does seem to at least move momentum towards Sweden's membership in a much more positive direction. The Ukraine part is really interesting too. You know, the reactions in my mind. Ukraine has a really, really effective public relations strategy that is designed to pressure NATO members primarily and other allies to maximize support for them. And that strategy is essentially to say, we love what you're giving us, but we're never satisfied with it. You can always give us more and you always should give us more. And I think a lot of this NATO conversation fits a little bit into that bucket, but there may be one added element that's a little more contentious. You know, as Ravi, as you know, I completely agree. I don't think anyone came into this thinking Ukraine was going to get membership anytime soon, or frankly, was going to get a firm commitment to join. It's a controversial decision. Other NATO members are going to have issues with it. It's something you have to talk over a lot more and probably not really going to see a solid discussion until the war is at least headed on a trajectory towards ending, because of the broader, you know, alliance implications. But, you know, we see a level of coordination. There's this clear sign of support for Ukraine. But here it does seem like Ukraine wanted something more like clear benchmarks, a clear path to say, here's the things we need to do and a timeline in which we can expect to see it considered or expect to get us evaluated on those benchmarks to move towards membership. And they didn't even get that. And I actually think that is a little bit of a concern that ties into Ukrainian domestic politics. A lot of the big barriers that seem to exist for particularly the Biden administration and a lot of countries that probably would be much more open to Ukraine joining NATO than maybe certain other NATO members like Poland is a lot of domestic reform around things like transparency, democratic governance, corruption. And it's this interesting tension, right? We know in NATO history, NATO brought in Turkey and Greece and other members for geopolitical strategic reasons primarily, and at various times has found that to be problematic because they're allies that bring in a lot of problems to the alliance that don't always share values, share the same agenda. I think there's some concern about that, about Ukraine too. It's hard to reconcile that with our vision of the genuine and accurate vision of heroism that we see coming out of Ukraine every day, where they really are at the forefront of a functioning democracy. But they're also a democracy that has a lot of systematic problems yet. And addressing them is really difficult. And it's going to be domestically difficult for Zelensky or anyone else. And I think there may have been a hope they may have been able to use this moment to leverage NATO to relax some of those requirements, signal that some of this stuff we're going to find ways around or we're going to stop caring about as much. And the fact that the NATO alliance wasn't inclined to do that, I do think maybe hits a little closer to home for Zelensky and other Ukrainian politicians, because it means that they're going to still feel a lot of international pressure to try and make progress on these really difficult, deeply entrenched domestic issues that are going to be really challenging for them to tackle. Certainly against the backdrop of a war, but even if the war were to end, are still going to be really, really big challenges.
Yeah, those are such great points. I mean, you know, just to riff on what you said about Ukraine's PR being great, they have consistently, right from the start, framed themselves as being, you know, at the vanguard of the fight between democracies and autocracies, as being the defenders of sovereignty, as, you know, even being able to reframe a relationship with the West, where it's so clear that they need the West. But in recent months, they've also begun to say, wait a minute, you need us. We are the ones who are fighting off the Russians. We are the ones who are battle-hardened and battle-trained. And if you want NATO to have a really strong military in the future, we're the ones who could give you that strength and support. We're the ones who have, you know, a military that the whole world has seen as being, you know, heroic, as fighting in a way, in a manner that has inspired, I think, some of the other countries as well. So they're, I think, very cleverly at the world stage, able to put forward what they've done so far and to take it beyond just their borders. I mean, their constant framing of Russia's invasion as something that cuts at the heart of the rules-based liberal order. They've also taken this message, by the way, outside of Europe. They frequently now engage with the global South. They've, in fact, invested a lot of time and effort and people into traveling around the world to go speak to people in New Delhi, in Doha, and elsewhere, and say, look, this could happen to you as well in the future, not just by Russia, but potentially by China. And so, you know, when we are the ones who are defending borders, who are defending the very idea of sovereignty, you need to support us. And I think that that's part of their pitch about NATO as well. They're making it sort of existential. They're making it about values and ideals, which makes it so much harder to resist them. I mean, beyond the stuff, the obvious stuff that you've pointed out about corruption, about democracy, other rules that NATO has often imposed on potential member states. And there's a pathway to that. And I think that's why Zelensky seemed as upset as he did this week. They want a pathway. They have very clearly said, I think Zelensky tweeted, that uncertainty is weakness. They want strength, and therefore they want some certainty. They want a path.
So I want to go back to Erdogan for a minute. At risk of opening a real can of worms, do we have any sense of why he did this 180-degree turn? I feel like just the other week I was reading articles about how, you know, Sweden was really frustrated. This was going to be a long slog. There were ways for NATO to kind of get around Erdogan's blockade and incorporate Sweden in sort of backdoor ways into the alliance, but it was not going to be easy. And then, you know, I woke up the other morning and there it was. Erdogan had changed his mind. Do we have any indication of what it was? I mean, he's mercurial, but presumably there's a method to the madness.
Yeah, I don't think it's just one factor. I imagine, so the method to the madness is drama. I mean, Erdogan is a master of controlling the media. He realizes how much everyone needs his vote. And so he's basically been playing for time and playing for little concessions here and there that he can get out of the West. And I think if you flip this and look at what does he really need, and there are two things really. I mean, of course, he wanted those F-16s. And I think the commitment to get those to Ankara over time, even though there might be some conditions attached, for example, the fact that they might not be able to use those F-16s over Greek airspace, for example, could be a thing. But of course, that should be seen in the context of Turkey-Greece relations improving a bit, especially after the devastating earthquake that Turkey had in February. And Greece was very quick to come to Turkey's aid, which I think has improved relations between the two. But more broadly, if there's a number that I think is very salient in this discussion, I think that number would be 37.7 billion. And that is Turkey's current account deficit, which has ballooned over the last few months. It is now at a record. And I think, quite frankly, Erdogan is worried about the economy in a way that he may not have been before, because they could be headed towards a balance of payments crisis. And, you know, I think we're also entering an era where foreign policy is just so intertwined with economics and trade and economic relations. And, you know, Erdogan must have, you know, really been mulling over those numbers, those current account deficit numbers, and realized that, you know, if everyone sees him as the holdout, and if he's too unpopular, that could have economic ramifications. And he needs the West to invest in Turkey. He needs foreign companies to come in. He is going to need aid from international lending institutions as well. And he knows who holds the keys to them. So I think that's a big part of this as well, that we may see playing out in the next few months.
So before we close this topic out, I kind of want to zoom out and ask if we can make any conclusions, tentative as they nevertheless will be, and of course we still have a day of the summit left, about what this summit and what the Ukraine issues and the Turkey issues and the Sweden issues can tell us about what I think is kind of the ever-present question, which is, you know, what is the state of NATO, right? Just a few days ago, the New York Times published a piece raising some concerns that, you know, now that we're over a year into this war, the initial solidarity among NATO nations is beginning to crack. There are some more tensions. At the same time, it seems to me that this summit is actually going quite well and NATO is functioning exactly as it should, even though, of course, there are conflicts. So, you know, as the president would say, you know, is the state of NATO strong? Ravi, what do you think?
You know, my overarching sense is yes, it is strong. If you take it in the context of the last decade or so, it is much stronger than it was 2 years ago or 5 years ago or a decade ago. And so the trajectory, I think, is very important here. There are disagreements. There will always be disagreements. And that's partly because of how NATO is set up. I mean, you can have one country that, such as Turkey, that sort of sticks out and holds up things like Sweden's accession or Finland's accession in the past year. There are disagreements on spending levels, on how much to arm Ukraine, on other sort of issues on defense posture. I think longer term is where I worry more about divides within NATO. And the more that NATO tries to look beyond just the Russia issue, which clearly united them in a way that has rejuvenated the alliance over the last 2 years. But when it comes to China, when it comes to other NATO activities, say in Africa, I think that's what I look to when I sort of project forward and imagine where there might be even more serious divides within NATO. I mean, for example, on China, which NATO last year designated as a, you know, strategic threat, there are clear differences on how to deal with China between the United States and Europe. Within Europe, there are very clear differences between, say, some of the Eastern European states, which need China a lot more than some of the Western European states. And then you have countries like France that, you know, every now and then just, you know, do France and say, well, we need to go our own way, or we need to take a whole bunch of CEOs to Beijing to make sure that we're doing business with China. So I think those are areas that I worry more about the alliance's ability to stick together. But for now, flip all of this. If you were Vladimir Putin and you're looking at Vilnius, you're going to be worried. You're going to be worried by the signs you see of very clear unity. And beyond that, a clear focus in staying the course and trying to make sure that Ukraine ends up, if not winning, at the very least, imposing serious, long-lasting costs on Russia's military.
So we've mentioned the fact that the United States has decided to give cluster bombs to Ukraine. And along with the NATO summit, I think this is kind of the big Ukraine news of the week. So a cluster bomb, for listeners who aren't familiar, is a kind of munition that sort of breaks into different pieces, hence clusters. I've also seen them referred to as bomblets, which sounds incongruously cute. This news has caused a lot of consternation in the press among disarmament advocates, because cluster bombs are not widely used anymore. There is an international convention against their use. Notably, neither the United States nor Ukraine nor Russia has signed onto it, and Russia has been using cluster bombs throughout the war so far. The Biden administration's reasoning is essentially, look, you know, Ukraine is in the middle of this crucial offensive. They're running out of other munitions. This kind of weapon can be extremely useful in doing what they need to do in terms of breaking through Russian lines. And, you know, the American munitions that they're using would have a lower risk of potentially injuring civilians later on than the munitions that Russians have already been using on the same battlefields. The argument against this is essentially that, you know, these munitions have been shown to be dangerous. They have a tendency to sort of lurk in fields and injure civilians years and decades on. Much of the world does consider them to be something that should be barred in warfare. And so there's been a real debate going back and forth. Axios even had a piece suggesting that some members of Congress on both sides of the aisle are moving toward trying to prevent these weapons from being passed to Ukraine. So Scott, let me start with you, and then Ravi, I'm also curious for your thoughts. What do you make of this debate? What side do you come down on? How are you understanding the different arguments that are being made?
It's a really difficult question. I think anybody who says it's an easy answer to this is not giving the issue due credit, and both sides due credit. You know, this is a case where the United States has kept these weapons in its inventory, has kept the legal authority to use them, has not signed on to treaties banning them for a strategic reason. They are essentially force multipliers. They allow you to take a single rocket, single missile, and do with it what you would otherwise require a range of armaments to do, because you're turning one rocket into 20 rockets, 30 rockets, 40 rockets with these little bomblets distributing across an area. You know, that is something that is particularly useful for Ukraine in this particular moment, because Ukraine is, you know, fighting with a well-armed and well-supported by NATO and other allies, but nonetheless, you know, constrained in a lot of regards, military, with military hardware. It doesn't have air superiority. It can't control and target weapons and deliver things with the sort of precision and volume that the United States can in asymmetrical warfare type environments like Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan. That's just not what Ukraine's dealing with. And frankly, that's not like the type of wars you're likely to see between major powers or major military powers, right? That's kind of a weird historical exception the United States has lived in for the last 20 to 30 years. Instead, every inch of territory is really hard fought and hard won. And when you see an opening, you want to make the most of it. And that is what cluster munitions let you do. The downside is that they're really damaging on territory. They linger for a long time. And the trade-off of this means of this decision by the Biden administration is that Ukraine's probably gonna be able to fight the war more effectively now. And we're probably gonna hear about Ukrainian children 10 years from now, if God willing, Ukrainians win and take their territory back, who die at the hands of an American weapon. Because they find it in a field. And that's going to be horribly tragic and a hard thing to live through. And we're going to look back at it and say, God, was this really worth it when you see that human cost? I think probably the factor that tipped the case in this case for the Biden administration, certainly this is what Jake Sullivan suggests in his comments kind of justifying the decision, is that this is a war being fought by Ukraine, who's asking for these on Ukrainian territory. And that in the end, they are the ones who are in the position to make those sorts of really hard decisions about how do we balance the future health and well-being of our territory, of our population, versus their immediate needs in this ongoing conflict. That said, you know, the thing to bear in mind about this is that this is going to be an ongoing dialogue. You don't just hand over a box of these weapons and that's it, and Ukraine can do whatever it wants with them. There's a supply chain. It's going to be an ongoing relationship. It is going to be subject to conditions and discussions and agreements that the United States can put limits on. I, for example, guarantee you that there will be a limit that says you can only use these in Ukrainian territory. You can't use them in Russia, which has been the case with a lot of armaments that the United States has provided to Ukraine. Crimea, I'd be curious actually what the position is on Crimea. I suspect they will be allowed to use it on Crimea. But maybe not. I mean, maybe they'll see that as difficult if that's territory that's seen as likely as remaining in Russian hands de facto, if not de jure. So, you know, the United States is going to be in a position to exercise leverage. That's what you get when you build these sorts of relationships. They are a double-edged sword because they're a dependency, essentially, if you're going to keep using these weapons. And so the conversation will keep happening, and the United States is going to have to make efforts to make sure Ukraine uses these responsibly and not recklessly. But that said, I see the logic of both sides. I share the concern with these weapons, but I'm not ultimately surprised. And I'm not sure I even disagree with the Biden administration's ultimate decision and where it came out on this, although it's a hard call. Ravi, what is your sense of it? What enters into your balance of the different factors here?
I mean, I thought that was a really good summary. You know, I'm so glad that like I don't have to make that decision, you know, and so I'm with you on that. You know, the framework through which I see this is that war sucks. Tough decisions have to be made. And, you know, last week when I was interviewing Anders Fogh Rasmussen, who's on the NATO Secretary General, of course, you know, and I was pushing him on why Biden would make this decision. And he said something that really just stayed with me. He said, I don't like it. I don't like it at all. And then he went on to explain why it was necessary. And I feel like that's a useful lens through which to see it. It is awful. Like, there is no one who should be making the case for why this is a good thing. It is an awful thing. in an awful situation. But in as much as the guiding force behind the decision is that Ukraine is using it anyway, they need more. They are using it on their turf, on their soil. They are likely the ones who will suffer the most from it, and they still want to use it. In as much as those are sort of the decision points, the decision sort of factors, I get why the Biden administration is doing this. I think they really need to shift the tide of the counteroffensive right now, and this is one way that they can at least try to push, you know, Russian sort of military from the positions that they're in. It sort of, you know, could help that a little bit. Desperate times, desperate measures, really.
Yeah, I don't think I have anything particularly intelligent to add in terms of the wisdom of this move. And I probably agree with Ravi and Scott that it is both unfortunate and necessary. I am curious if the pushback we're seeing from at least some members of Congress, where there is kind of an interestingly bipartisan flavor to that pushback with a combination of sort of progressive Democrats, along with your sort of more isolationist Republicans who I'm not sure care that much about the cluster munitions issue, but I think are more just finding this a useful way of kind of pushing back against American support for Ukraine. I'm curious if that will dissipate in a few days and we'll never hear about this, or if this sort of might be the beginning of a more critical pushback from this sort of far left and far right caucus kind of working together, that for its own reasons is getting increasingly skeptical of U.S. support to Ukraine.
My instinct is it will dissipate in the specifics. I think we should all be really glad that they are raising concerns, human rights concerns, the likes of which we've been discussing. I mean, we will hear of horrific deaths because of dud bomblets that will explode at some point in the future. This will affect children and civilians. We should talk about it. It's really good that folks in Congress are bringing this up. But as you point out, they may be bringing it up in a Machiavellian way in that it serves broader points that they want to make in any case, which is the broader issue of U.S. support for Ukraine. And so we have certainly not heard the last of that debate. I think, you know, the progressives will continue to question in their own way how much support should be given and what kind of support. And on the right, as we know from some of the people who are running for the GOP nomination, there's a broader sort of question, a strategic question of whether the US should be supporting Ukraine at all in a quote-unquote territorial dispute, to use Ron DeSantis's phrase, instead of focusing on China. So obviously, I think cluster munitions would come up in that context. But now that that decision is made and promises have been made, I think, you know, this particular issue will end up sort of getting buried over the next few weeks. But the broader issue will have other flashpoints within them, I imagine.
That's the sound of another sale on Shopify in store. Shopify POS is everything you need to sell in person. From payments to inventory, Shopify unites your sales into one commerce platform. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/retail23. Shopify.com/retail23.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed
my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20.
I 100% agree with that. And I think that there's a potentially tricky dynamic emerging here for Ukraine that's worth thinking about a little bit. And I don't know exactly the trajectory it's going on, but this is where I'm worried it's going to some extent, which is that there is a broad presumption around many, primarily Republican legislators, almost entirely Republican legislators, that the Biden administration is both not helping Ukraine enough in certain ways, at least for those who support backing Ukraine, and then doing what they are doing too expensively, committing too much U.S. resources or taking too much focus away from China, other strategic priorities. And it creates this little tricky dynamic where essentially you have a lot of legislators who want to say, this is setting aside kind of the extreme isolationist crowd, but in kind of the more middle band, a lot of legislators that want to find ways to criticize what the Biden administration is doing while also showing some degree of support to Ukraine. They want talking points. They can say, here's what I've helped give to Ukraine. This proves my bona fides of saying I'm not weak on Russia. I'm strong on backing Ukraine. That frees me to oppose other parts of the Biden agenda. And this is really tricky, I think, actually, for Ukraine, and a hard thing for them to think about, because the inclination is to say, I want to keep making all these asks of Congress. We see all these legislative proposals saying, oh, let's designate Russia a state sponsor of terrorism, or make up a new designation to assign to Russia. Let's do these other measures that are primarily symbolic or have a somewhat limited marginal impact from a policy perspective. Congress is gloms onto those. We see members of Congress really get attracted to those ideas, including in this camp. And I think part of the reason is because they're free talking points. They're talking points that you see legislators are going to be in a position to be able to use and say, oh, of course I back Ukraine. I think Russia is state sponsored terrorism and I want to designate them as such. Whereas the Biden administration won't even do that. But because they have those talking points, if they collect enough of those, they're much freer to push back on the other types of assistance that they don't like from a bottom line perspective, but that's probably much more important to Ukraine, which is frankly straight military and security assistance right now. And so it's going to become, as this tension builds, I think a more difficult trade-off that Ukraine needs to think about. Like, you can't make too many asks or engage too much with Congress on this because you're just giving talking points to people who are trying to find a way to weasel out of giving you the support you need. And you've got to keep the focus on the most important items as the environment grows more skeptical, which is the trajectory that seems to be headed in. Hopefully I'm wrong. Hopefully that's an overly cynical take of the politics around this, but I'm a little worried that's what the next 12 months is likely to look like.
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, we've all been talking about how good Ukraine's PR is, how strategic they've been in, you know, not only making requests, but in sort of airing them out publicly, in sort of being able to portray themselves as defenders of the West, and also sort of being very attuned to different talking points within various factions in the United States. As much as we talk about all of that, I think, you know, one way of looking at what you're saying is there is a danger that they could be too clever by half if they try to play too many of these sides against each other in the U.S. That could end up backfiring longer term. I think that they've been very disciplined so far, but they do walk it up to that line where they seem just a bit too attuned to the debate here.
Well, let us transition the conversation from dropping bomblets to throwing bombs, because we have seen a little bit of a tiff arise between two of our glorious tech geniuses that loom over the landscape of our society in the form of Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk. One that is manifested in ways with real consequences day to day for those of us who live in the media environment that we all live in these days, at least the four of us on this call. And that is a new contender that has emerged to Twitter, which was for a very long time kind of the town square of certainly the American media, of a lot of Americans, a lot of people around the world. I think that was actually a claim that was fairly accurate, and a descriptor that's fairly accurate for a long time, but has been on the decline since coming under the ownership of Elon Musk, and now is facing its stiffest competitor yet, the Threads app, which Meta, the company owned by Mark Zuckerberg and led by Mark Zuckerberg, formerly known as Facebook, has rolled out, that attracted 100 million users in its first week. Now, admittedly, a lot of those being imported from Instagram, an existing platform, but nonetheless, a pretty broad reach, pretty fast, which has obviously stirred some alarm in the Elon Musk camp to the point that he is challenging Zuckerberg to a penis measuring contest on Twitter, among other fairly childish measures.
Literally.
Not a joke.
I think it's very important to understand that he called Zuckerberg a cuck and suggested that they measure penises, to which Zuckerberg, I have to say, who's just impressing me more and more every day, just responded, "This is concerning."
Although it's also important to note that there's like a 6-hour difference between the cuck tweet and the penis measuring tweet. Like, he posted the cuck tweet and then he sat there, and then 6 hours later he was like, you know what, I could really add something to this.
Like, how do I diffuse this situation?
It was getting ratioed. He wasn't getting the enough likes, you know. You gotta up the ante a little bit. Despite the somewhat absurd and ridiculous optics of this competition, it's got real consequences, because now we're seeing a pretty big center of gravity, more so than I think for other platforms in terms of scope, although it's different when you're talking about different types of users of Twitter. But in terms of sheer scope, and particularly I feel like the kind of popular culture element, a lot of it people are signaling that Threads is where they see their social media engagement moving. And this is all happening at a time when Twitter is facing, in the last week, just a kind of barrage of technical issues, including some that have affected our very own lawformedia.org, much to our annoyance. So, Alan, let me start with you on this, because I know you are a big fan of another competitor of Twitter from back in the day that you've written on extensively and have thought a lot about this. Tell us a little bit about where this fits into this conversation. Like, what does it mean that Threads is here and has so quickly established itself as having a major network of users? And what will it mean to have a diversified information kind of ecosystem as we get to the 2024 election and other events that we know are going to be hubs of disinformation and discussion?
Ah, Mastodon, we hardly knew ye. So you're right, Scott, that I have been following Mastodon with a lot of interest. I've even written some academic work about it. And
you toot with the best of them.
I do. You know what? So this is the irony, though. Like, despite me being into like academically super interested in all these issues, I am, when it comes to my actual practice, like super boring. I'm still basically just on Twitter. I still hate it. I'm actually kind of excited for all these social media companies to burn so that maybe I can stop doing this and go back to just engaging with the world through RSS feeds, which honestly, I still think is the peak of communications technology on the internet. The last couple of months, or the last, I don't know, 6 months or so, thinking about Threads, thinking about Blue Sky, thinking about Mastodon, I think to me has pointed out some ways in which I was sort of wrong in my initial excitement about Mastodon as a replacement for Twitter, but that maybe I was right about sort of the bigger picture and what matters going forward. What I think the really remarkably quick rise of Threads, which has gotten, you know, tens of millions of users basically overnight, what I think that shows is how important user-facing design is, how important it is when you're building a social network to make it fun and to make it really easy to use. Now, part of that for Threads is not any genius design. It's just that they're basically taking your Instagram login and then allowing you to use that for your Threads and also to keep all your followers. And so it's a way of preserving that social media capital that you've built up, right? That's there's nothing innovative about that. They're just exploiting very intelligently, and that's exactly what they should be doing, an existing network effect. But part of it is also, I think, them realizing that, you know, things like algorithmic news feeds, which Mastodon does not implement, and things like quote tweets, which I think Threads does implement, or if it doesn't, it's going to. But either way, something also Mastodon does not implement. These things are really important. Now, Mastodon has reasons for not implementing them. They have ideological reasons. And I respect those reasons. But, you know, you have to pay for your ideology at some point. And one of those is with mass adoption. So in that sense, you know, I no longer think in a way that I thought was at least possible a year ago that Mastodon was going to replace Twitter as the future platform. I'm still not sure it's going to be Threads. Maybe it'll be Blue Sky. Maybe it'll be something else. But whatever it is, it's going to be something really slick and something really fun and something really easy and something that does not try to solve the pathologies of modern social media, right? In a way that Mastodon tried to, because people like the pathologies of modern social media, sadly. On the other hand, what I think is really notable about Threads and Blue Sky as well is that they're both decentralized. And I think it's something we haven't really talked about. So like Mastodon, Threads is built on the ActivityPub protocol. So the architecture, although it's currently basically entirely controlled by Meta, will interoperate with ActivityPub. So, you know, from the outside, Threads will just look like any other ActivityPub instance. Now, it'll be the biggest one by far. It'll have tens of millions of users and it'll have outsized effects. But Meta is still committing itself to decentralization. And it's still committing itself to letting go of some control and of not being able to exercise quite the same level of exhaustive moderation that it currently does on Instagram and Facebook. I mean, they'll still be able to moderate the Threads servers, but, you know, people will still be able to access Threads from outside of Threads, and people will be able to access things outside of Threads from inside of Threads. That's notable. Blue Sky is also decentralized, not on ActivityPub, but on some other protocol. And I think what that does show is that the thing that most excited me about Mastodon, which was the decentralized nature, that thing is really going to be the future. And people are going to build applications on top of that, and we'll see what application wins, but that the future is fundamentally decentralized. And we can talk about why that is and what the benefits and cons are. I think that is, in addition to being the future, also a good thing. And so this is what I mean when I say, I think I was wrong about Mastodon itself, but I think I was right about what was interesting about Mastodon, which was the decentralized aspect. And it's just, I have to emphasize, it is really notable that, you know, a lockdown system like Meta has decided for its next social media platform to go decentralized.
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. I guess I big shocker that I'm going to disagree with Alan.
We got to hear both sides, Quinta. Please go ahead. Bring it.
Oh, how the tables have turned.
Yeah, Alex Stamos at the Stanford Internet Observatory has posted some on Threads, making the argument that this ActivityPub commitment is kind of a red herring, whether or not Meta understands it as such, and saying that he would guess that they're probably not going to be end up committing to ActivityPub because it means that they're going to have to deal with a lot of content that they'll be responsible for when it's cross-posted onto their servers that they have no moderating capacity over.
Can I just make a quick technical point there? So I haven't read the what do they call them? Threads?
I have
threads
no
now?
Idea.
Thread, whatever.
Piece of string.
To be clear, the point of ActivityPub is not that you have to let everything onto your instance. It's just that overall, anything can exist on the network. So, you know, they will still be able to moderate crap from outside if they want to.
Yeah, I mean, my understanding, without speaking for Alex, is just that it involves a certain level of you lose a certain amount of control if people are posting things onto threads that are not within threads, and that if you are Meta, the pros and cons of that are the calculus is substantially different because you're a $1 billion company. So I don't know. I will say, actually, I, big shocker, had more of a downer view on the whole thing, and that we had this sort of moment where the future of social media could have been decentralized, not run by a billionaire. And now there was this moment where it seemed like Blue Sky might come to the fore. I have some thoughts about the distinctions between Blue Sky and Threads. And now Threads seems poised to kind of scoop up the market. And I just frankly find that kind of depressing insofar as it means that, you know, we're now going from a world where there are, you know, three or four huge social media companies to a world where there are two or three social media companies. And the, you know, continuing hegemony of Meta, I don't think is honestly particularly good for anybody. Now, of course, people will say Jack Dorsey is on the board of Blue Sky, which is true. I think that Mastodon was sort of the ideologically purist, for lack of a better term, model here. But it does just strike me as kind of depressing, frankly.
Ravi, I'd be really curious about your perspective on this, particularly as someone who runs a media platform. I mean, a magazine, obviously, but you're more than a magazine with podcasts and videos. And that is obviously kind of walking the line between old media and new media. What challenges does this present? And particularly when you think about disinformation and responsibility as an editor, as a publisher, how does this intersect with that, with all these different outlets?
That's such a great question. But, you know, before I come to that, I just wanted to riff off of Alan and Quintus' points. I agree that decentralization is going to be really important in the future. But I also think there's one other component to this that I've been thinking a lot about over the last few years, and that's that we're never going to have one global public square again. I think the early days of Twitter, you know, back when it launched, it was so cool that you could discover, you know, if there's an air sort of incident in Schiphol Airport, someone is going to sort of microblog about that on Twitter and you find out instantly. And you, that sort of very global connected sense, that sort of monoculture moment where everyone's on it and therefore I have to be on it and therefore it's indispensable. I think that moment's kind of gone pre-Elon Musk. And I think he's accelerated all of that because of the way in which he's handled Twitter. But, you know, there are so many other platforms now. There are so many other parts of the world that think of social media in a very different way. I mean, Threads isn't even in Europe for now. So even though the numbers are as large as they are, a large part of the world has been ignored. You know, personally, and this is where all of your listeners will think I'm a freak, but I use LinkedIn, and I think that's sort of the earnest, verified kind of place that I tend to trust because, you know, I mean, people are just less rude on LinkedIn because I can see where they went to school and I can see who their boss is. And
sweet, sweet Ravi, I love it. He just wants to use LinkedIn. Can't we all just use LinkedIn?
Use LinkedIn. LinkedIn is great. People are just not as rude, and the engagement is nicer. But all of that said, you know, if we enter this sort of fragmented world, you know, there's a lot of wish fulfillment about Threads as well. And I think we see that in the Zuck kind of Elon fight where, you know, we're also mad at Elon Musk, that we're kind of rooting for Zuck to succeed with Threads. And I think ultimately, like a lot of what Zuck is doing with Threads is this massive gathering of data, which I think they're going to use for AI. I think they have figured out the advertising game better than anyone else bar Google. And this is, you know, one more way in which they're going to be listening to our discussions and, you know, synthesizing our words and be able to sell us everything from underwear to shoes in a way that is even more eerie than before. So there's all of that. But Scott, to answer your question, as a news publisher, and I say this as, you know, the editor of a magazine that really focuses on subscriptions, we've been burned in the past by the promise of advertising, by the promise of clickbait, by the promise of big numbers, by the promise of relying too much on social media, let alone one social media platform. So we actually get very little traffic from social media. Search is much bigger for us. We also focus much more on the people who are paying for FPs, the subscribers versus general readers. And I think that's also more of an industry trend where, you know, there's a broader disillusionment with advertising and with being held hostage to a social media platform. I mean, all it would take, let's say Twitter or Threads ends up being like 5 or 10% of your revenue in some form if they control it. All it takes is a tiny tweak of an algorithm, and then you've lost that amount of revenue, and then you need to lay off journalists. I mean, so as an editor, to me, it's infuriating that I would ever need to depend on them. And I think for years now, we've been trying to depend on any of these platforms less and less and less, rely more on other ways of reaching people directly, rely more on search and SEO, which to some extent makes us dependent on Google and Bing and other search engines. So there's that, but also just diversifying in a world in which social media is more fragmented. Different types of communities, different types of geographies are using different platforms, and you want to reach all of them. You kind of have to play all of these games. And I feel much more comfortable hedging my bets across 20 different platforms than I do any one. And so what I'm looking forward to the most from Threads really is that they get on Buffer, which is a software we use to put out the same piece on several different platforms all at once. And I would like them to extend their API to allow us to be able to post on Threads just as we do on other platforms without curating for it separately. So if they make it easier for us, I think we'll use it more. But I refuse to depend or rely on any one platform.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense, especially because Threads was produced by the same people who brought you the Pivot to Video of 2015, which led to... the complete decimation of the journalism industry. And I've seen a lot of folks say, you know, I'm not trusting Zuckerberg ever again. Adam Mosseri, the head of Instagram, and now I guess also the head of Threads, posted saying that they're intentionally trying to design the platform so that it is not a hotbed of news and current events. Query how sustainable that commitment will be, but I think it's consistent with a larger kind of rollback that we've seen on the Facebook platform of the extent to which the platform was boosting news topics. That's a complicated issue because part of that rollback had to do with trying to lower, you know, toxic conversations and metrics that lead to increased polarization on the platform, but it also really, really hurt news organizations in terms of their reach. And so it does seem like Threads now is sort of currently designed not to be an app where publishers can do very much, which, you know, there's whatever happens, digital media will always lose. It's just one of the iron laws of the universe. I would maybe hope that that would, as you say, Ravi, kind of perhaps make us all think a little bit more about what it means to be so dependent on a single platform or a set of platforms and try to diversify away from that. But it's hard to say.
Well, and I think that really underscores what I expect to come out of this to some extent, which is that like we're not going to have, not only are you not going to have one square, you're going to have different sub-communities in different squares or using different platforms for very different purposes, right? Like Threads does seem like, at least right now, this could change, but is going to have both an inclination against becoming like a news aggregator and a big forum for news and political discussion, and might have some disadvantages there because of its messy history with Facebook and Facebook's own difficult experiences with those issues and the distrust it breeds in journalists and, frankly, like a lot of people on the political left and a lot of people in policy circles, because Meta has such a messy history of this. But that hub of people, frankly, the conventional media, their use of Twitter is what made Twitter so powerful for a lot of people. It's a big reason why it was such a political driver and why you saw people become kind of like, you know, not overnight, but near overnight celebrities around certain issues, is because they would hit a hot thread on Twitter, and then all of a sudden they would be on MSNBC or on CNN or on Fox News, depending on what they're talking about and their inclination, and they would get kind of amplified. And it was this huge way to enter yourself into a much bigger media ecosphere. And like, that's the question to me, is when is the conventional media a center of gravity going to shift, and where is it going to shift to another platform? And is it going to be just one? Because we already see different communities use different platforms really differently. Like LinkedIn, to me, is the one that I associate with private sector. Like my friends who are in consulting or finance or business, like they're all over LinkedIn. They put so much more stuff on LinkedIn than any other platform. Facebook is old people, I think, primarily. I don't really know what Facebook is for, but it's like a lot of people about family and pictures and things like that. Instagram was like,
it's a lot of traffic from Facebook, Scott. Don't be rude.
And I love it. I am an old person by most measures at this point. So, you know, I'm not, no hate. I'm just saying, but it's like a different demographic I haven't quite figured out. But Instagram was like young and people who are like care about celebrity and picture and image, because so much more visually based. And Threads seems to be trying to kind of draft in behind Instagram and say, yeah, we're gonna be a pop culture discussion. We're not gonna try and be like a big newsy heavy site. And maybe that's good for outreach and sheer number of users, but it's not as good for these certain ways people use Twitter powerfully in the back era. And so a lot of it is gonna be weird market cultural forces about how this all sorts out. And I don't think there's a clear path, but a much more, you know, diverse kind of system of these things, to my mind, just means we end up with more specialized kind of niches, as opposed to Twitter, which somehow, while there were still those other niches, pulled much more heavily from all of them in a unique way.
Honestly, I think that's great.
It might not be a bad thing. Yeah,
I think general public squares are hugely overrated. I mean, we're just not meant, like, human beings are meant to, you know 150 people, right? That's the Dunbar number, right? It's bad enough that modernity requires us to, you know, keep thousands of people in our minds, but a public square of a billion people is just an absolute disaster. You just get endless context collapse. It's absolutely miserable. And yeah, I would so much rather a tiny social media platform with, you know, journalists, policy people, and academics, and just like, that's all I want to talk about. I don't need all the other crap coming into my feed.
Yeah,
I think you need to stop this thing, whatever it is that you're describing. Let's do it.
LinkedIn just sounds so nice. But I will say, there is an interesting question, Ravi, like about why LinkedIn can't play this role. Like, you're right, it's a bunch of professionals. There are real reasons why the tenor of this conversation will be better, right? Because you're like, employer and all that stuff is right there. I actually don't understand why LinkedIn can't do this, except for the fact that it is just undeniably not a cool platform. And so, like, I feel like I think, as silly as that sounds, some of that does get in the way. But like, God, I'm happy to just move to LinkedIn.
I would encourage you to look at it. I mean, it is, you're right, it's not particularly cool. It's incredibly earnest. But, you know, when I post things about foreign policy on LinkedIn, I get a lot of engagement, and I get sometimes critical messages, sometimes supportive messages, but unfailingly, they are actually smart. They read the thing that I've posted. They make points that are important points. They actually behave, again, because, you know, their bosses are looking at them. Their networks are looking at them. And so I think LinkedIn has really begun to expand outside of just the private sector, outside of economics and, you know, posts about jobs. I mean, I'll give you one data point. When I post something, I can actually search and see which companies are looking at my posts the most. Top two most days, U.S. Department of State, U.S. Defense Department. They're looking, they're watching, they're engaging. So I think it's really begun to sort of move outside of the private sector. But again, it's very geeky, it's very wonky. And, you know, I celebrate that. I mean, the, you know, if it attracts geeks and wonks, and they're enjoying themselves there, more power to all of them and me.
Well, folks, unfortunately, we will have to end the conversation there because we're out of time and bring it to LinkedIn or Twitter or Mastodon continue the conversation in another form of our choice. But this would not be rational security if we did not leave you with some object lesson to ponder over in the week to come until we are back in your podcatcher. Alan, what do you have for us this week?
Scott, I think you'll be really proud of me because I'm finally doing a music recommendation, and it's a live music recommendation.
Hey.
So one of my absolute favorite artists is Bella Fleck, who is, I think, the greatest American banjoist of his generation, which I know sounds kind of niche, but seriously, this guy is a like monster virtuoso. And I actually, like, one of my first bands that I was like super into when I was a teenager was his progressive jazz bluegrass fusion group, Bella Fleck and the Flecktones. So good. I still can't listen to Sinister Minister without grooving to the embarrassment of everyone around me. But he is currently on tour.
He just released, demonstrated it, folks, and it was, in fact, embarrassing. the brief moment of grooving.
Like, there's like that, the white guy underbite and stuff. It's good. So he is currently on tour to promote his latest album, which goes back to his kind of bluegrass roots. It's called My Bluegrass Heart, and it won the Grammy Award for Best Bluegrass Album. And he's coming to Minneapolis this week to the Dakota, which is our fabulous jazz club. And we're going, my wife and I are going to see him this week, and I am so very excited. So he's still on tour this summer, but even if you can't watch him on tour, he is always worth listening to. His latest is My Bluegrass Heart. But again, I still have a soft spot for his Flecktones days. But he also has an amazing album. I forget what it's called, but it's an album of classical music. Like a lot of classical guitar pieces, like Segovia transcriptions, which then he retranscribes for banjo. And it's insane. It's just completely unclear how he's making that music. And it's just fabulous. So go listen to Bella Fleck.
All right. I like it. Good, diversify our music scene. Quinta, what do you have for us this week?
I would like to talk about the Barbie 9-line controversy, which is maybe my favorite thing that has happened in the last several months. So listeners are surely aware that there is a Barbie movie coming out next week, directed by, of all people, Greta Gerwig, written by, of all people, Greta Gerwig and Noah Baumbach. And it is banned in Vietnam because Vietnam claims that the Barbie movie promotes the 9-line. China's territorial claims in the South China Sea, very controversial. It is not totally clear still, like, what specifically in the Barbie movie is promoting the 9-line. I think the closest that people have gotten is a screenshot of Barbie standing in front of like a sort of scribbled map of the world that is very clearly supposed to be inaccurate because all the continents have like continued to drift apart from one another, and Asia is like rotated 90 degrees straight up and down. There are some dashed lines. There is one by Greenland, which is 10 dashes, and there is one by Asia, which is, I will note, 8 dashes, but it's not located by the South China Sea. So I truly have no idea what's going on here. I love everything about this. I should say, I could definitely buy that somebody in Hollywood was like, we can totally get a win and get this distributed in China if we just like doodle a dash here, nobody will notice. I can also buy that, in the words of someone interviewed in the New York Times about this very important controversy, the Vietnamese censors just like wanted to make themselves seem important. And this is also a win for Vietnam because now, you know, everybody is talking about Vietnam's opposition to the 9-line. You listener, you can make up your mind for yourself. But I am now completely obsessed with this.
And we're going to see it next week. Are you joining the Lawfare Barbie outing, Quinta?
Hell yes.
Oh man, it's going to be amazing.
And I'm going to keep an eye out for the 9-line while we're there.
I wasn't aware this was scheduled in the middle of the workday. I don't know who approved this.
That's okay. That could be more important.
Fair enough. Certainly nothing ever happens after 1 p.m. on a Friday in our industry, but that's okay. We'll see how that works out. Well, for my object lesson this week, I am giving a big thank you to a listener who recommended a book to me like over a year ago now. I somehow just downloaded it, never got around to actually listening to and or reading it, which I've been kind of switching back and forth on for the last week as I've gotten through it. But it's just phenomenal. And it's a classic of science fiction that I cannot recommend enough. And somehow is, I feel like, has fallen off the radar, whereas it used to be considered a real classic and people don't talk about it enough. And that's Red Mars, which is part of Kim Stanley Robinson's Mars trilogy. It is a phenomenal, phenomenal, really like literary work about a bunch of individuals who are among the first colonists of Mars, and follows their trajectory and their lives and their internal psychology as they wrestle with entering a whole new kind of era of human history and shaping politics and watching Earth become a more alien place and finding more at home on Mars in this new planet they've built and are terraforming. And it goes into incredible detail on the science, and which is evidently quite credible. It was written in 1992 or 1993. I will say there's some stuff in there that probably wouldn't be in there today. Kind of regrettable. Very strong takes on the Swiss in a weird way. He keeps coming back to having very strong views about Switzerland. I don't totally understand. Maybe it was a 90s thing I'm not caught up on, regardless. But just a phenomenal read, like just fascinating, really well done, very compelling characters. So I'm really excited. It's part of a trilogy, which I'm now digging into book two of. So cannot recommend that enough. And thank you, listener, who's I could not identify who it was before. But thank you so much for recommending this way back when I asked for science fiction recommendations. It's a great one. And I'm very excited to get through the rest of the trilogy. Ravi, why don't you bring us home? What do you have for us this week?
Sure. Well, I'm definitely going to watch The Hunt for Red October this evening. I've downloaded it, paid $3.99 for it on Apple. I'm going to watch it on the train back to New York. But my object lesson is a bit of a shameless plug, which kind of works nicely given our discussion about publishers and how we have to find other ways to monetize what we do. But I host a podcast called FP Live, and as the name suggests, I mean, it's FPE and it's live. And we often have live discussions on our website with really interesting, wonky, you know, world leaders, foreign ministers, people who really understand the issues that they work in. And we dive deep into one big issue every week, and sometimes more than once a week. That's live on our website. Anyone can join in for free. And if you want to watch the on video, if you want to watch the whole thing, the back catalog, you need to sign up to subscribe. But it's also a podcast, which I urge everyone to sign up for. Last week, as I mentioned earlier in this program, we had Anders Fogh Rasmussen talking about the NATO summit and the future of NATO. But this week, we've got a really cool one in which we're debating whether China's peaked or not. And it's a great discussion because we're always thinking about whether, you know, how to prosecute U.S. policy on China. But what there seems to be very little agreement on is, you know, where China is. I mean, has it really peaked in its growth? Or will demographics and a range of other factors lead it downwards? And if there's so much disagreement on China's trajectory, then how on earth are we going to agree on China policy? So that's a debate we've structured with you know, people for and against, very smart people who have done some research on it. But that's just an example of the kinds of debates we do. And we've recently had on John Kerry on climate cooperation with China, Colin Carr, who's at DOD, on America's defense posture, and a range of other terrific guests. So anyway, end of my shameless plug, but definitely urge and recommend all of you to download FP Live wherever you get your audio.
Wonderful. What a wonderful recommendation. But for better or for worse, that brings us to the end of this week's episode. Rational Security is, of course, a production of Lawfare, so be sure to visit us on our new webpage at lawfaremedia.org for our show page with links to past episodes, for show links that we reference in our discussions, for our written work, the work of other Lawfare contributors, and for information on Lawfare's other phenomenal podcast series. And while you're at it, be sure to follow us on Twitter at RRTLSecurity, and be sure to leave a rating or review wherever you might be listening. And while you're at it, also sign up to become a material supporter of Lawfare on patreon.com/lawfare for an ad-free version of this podcast and other special perks. Our audio engineer and producer this week was Noam Osband of Goat Rodeo, and our music, as always, was performed by Sophia Yan, and we are once again edited by the wonderful Jen Pacha Howell. On behalf of my co-host Alan Quinta and our special guest Ravi Agrawal, I am Scott R. Anderson, and we will talk to you next week. Until then, goodbye.
that's the sound of another sale on Shopify in store. Shopify POS is everything you need to sell in person. From payments to inventory, Shopify unites your sales into one commerce platform. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/retail23. Shopify.com/retail23.